One of the most debated issues in medical ethics today is the subject of whether to treat or not to treat critically ill newborns when paralysis, retardation, or physical handicaps accompany a life-threatening defect. Doctor and parents must agree on the treatment to be given. There was a case in Indiana in 1982 of an infant with Down syndrome that was denied treatment, and that brought the issue to public attention. Just this month, the federal government adopted regulations intended to influence that decision-making process. With me to discuss the regulation and the issue is George Mason Philosophy Professor Daniel Rothbart. Dr. Rothbart teaches medical ethics at George Mason University and serves on the Ethics Committee of Fairfax Hospital. Dr. Rothbart, under what circumstances might parents and doctor agree not to administer treatment to a critically ill newborn?
Well, there are a variety of possible situations where a newborn is, where the newborn's chance of survival is very low, or where the newborn has no chance of survival, basically. And in this case, there might be no treatment that would help the newborn at all, in which case it's not really a serious moral dilemma like the ones that have been in the press, you know, the baby Doe case.
A doctor has to recommend to the parents then that the child probably has no chance surviving.
That's right. Doctor recommends that the child would have no chance of surviving even with the treatment. That's the key thing.
What are some of the situations that have come up? Examples.
An example would be, I think, extreme examples of Tay-Sachs disease, extreme cases of spina bifida, where, again, the case would be that treatment would be hopeless in some extreme cases.
What is spina bifida?
Spina bifida is a genetic disease that's characterized by a deformation of the spine, and there is a leakage of spinal fluid, and in some cases it may be very severe, so that it may be so severe that there is no brain function, for example, or no bodily function.
Can you explain the baby Doe case a little bit?
Well, the baby Doe case involved a situation where the baby was born with Down syndrome. The physicians recommended to the parents that treatment should be withheld, in part on the basis of future handicaps to the newborn, such as mental retardation and also certain physical handicaps. And the parents agreed, and the treatment was withheld. And this went to court, and then that was sustained. The court decision, you know, confirmed the decision in that case.
Let's talk a little bit here about the doctor-patient relationship, because that's what becomes an issue.
Mm-hmm.
You've written an article, I know, on this, and why don't you just kind of explain it to us?
Well, one of the real problems is the difference between the law in this case and the facts of the situation, the reality of the situation. The law would roughly say, and this is very rough, that the parents must agree with the decision. The physician cannot make a decision without the parents' consent. Except, of course, if this goes to court, in which case a judge can override the parents acting in the child's benefit. But a decision to withhold treatment must have the parents' consent. But what happens in many cases with newborns is that the parents are in such an emotional state of anxiety and tension and pressure. In many cases, they had no idea that the child would be handicapped in any way. And so that's an initial shock. And so in these cases, they are not in a position to make a, quote, completely independent decision, a completely voluntary decision, which is the ideal. So they are extremely, you know, to a large degree, influenced by what the physician says. And it's just natural for the medical staff to recommend their own opinion, and natural for them to give their advice and say what the best course of action would be. So even if the decision is in the long run right, even if the physicians are morally correct, there is not a complete autonomous decision on the part of the parents.
What if a parent decides they want to withhold treatment and the doctor feels that that is not the correct choice?
Well, then a doctor, from a legal standpoint, does not have to participate at all in withholding life-saving treatment. And so the doctor can, the doctor can bring the case to court.
That's what basically. I was wondering. What responsibility does the doctor have?
Well, typically the doctor will bring the case to court. There are many cases of Jehovah's Witness parents who insist to the doctors that a simple blood transfusion to the child should not be given. And of course, doctors won't agree with that, in no case I've heard of at least. And it always goes to a judge. And in an emergency hearing, the judge will always rule for the physician that the treatment must be given. That's at least in every case I've heard of. That freedom of religion is to be respected, but not when it comes to threatening the life of a child.
This new regulation that has been reinterpreted essentially takes effect this month. Could you explain the regulation and the effect that it will have?
Okay. Basically, the regulation is put out by the Department of Health and Human Resources.
Services.
Health and Human Services, excuse me. And it says that the hospital cannot withhold medical treatment from newborns who have a handicap, who would otherwise receive medical treatment except for some mental or physical handicap. So in the case of, for example, spina bifida, there are some cases where doctors recommend the treatment should be withheld because of future handicaps of low IQ, for example, or something like that, as a primary reason. This law would rule that out as a reason for withholding medical treatment. You cannot use the future handicap as the basis for withholding medical treatment. That's what the rule says. And specifically, the rule would puts the federal financing on the line, that the federal money to these public hospitals would be withheld in such a case if the HHS decides that this has happened.
How would they even know if such a thing happened?
Part of the regulation is a series of enforcement conditions, and this includes posting a notice which announces that a hospital cannot withhold life-saving treatment in these cases. And under the notice, there is a toll-free hotline number, sort of, which nurses and doctors can call without any retaliation on the part of the hospital. It can be an anonymous call. And this is one of the very controversial aspects of this thing, because this is basically whistleblowing on this. The new form of this regulation, it was initially ruled out, thrown out of court, the way it was initially stated. But the new form will have the notice up in the doctors' and nurses' quarters, and anyone from the hospital can call this number.
What are some of the unique things about this particular regulation? I'm thinking specifically of the recommendation on a life advisory committee.
Okay, well, the suggestion here is that the government is saying that the decisions up to now have not been in the interest of society, in a sense. That's what the assumption is, that these decisions have not been consistent with some of the law, especially in terms of protecting the rights of handicapped. And so the recommendation is to prevent this from happening in the future by establishing life support committees. They're called a number of different things. And the life support committee, this is still in the very early stages of its development. It's a proposal by the Surgeon General of the United States, Everett Koop, who suggests that these committees maybe should hear cases which involve conflict between the parents and the physician. And in these cases, the committee would make sure that the newborn's interest would be protected. The committee it's suggested, would have an advisory function and not a final function of a complete decision-making function. It would have an advisory function. One of the purposes of this committee, and I think that this is a good motive for it, is to prevent cases from going to court, to prevent the complexities of a criminal case or a civil case, and to hope that that there's no need for the court action, because what's happened in many cases in court action is that it just hasn't worked out. It hasn't been to the satisfaction, certainly not of both parties. And in fact, many of the judges who do make a decision have stated in the past that that a committee should be formed to make a decision. And the advantage of a committee, it's claimed, is you do not have just one person's moral feeling that takes priority over everyone else's moral feeling about this. Rather, the goal, ideally, is to have a variety of moral viewpoints from different perspectives. So,
well, that suggests then that there would be people other than doctors and nurses on such a committee.
Right. The idea is that there would be social workers, possibly from the hospital, people in the hospital who were involved in the care, and also lay people, people from outside of the hospital, a chaplain, someone who's concerned, lawyers definitely, healthcare administrators possibly.
Does such an advisory committee exist anywhere now that you know of?
Not that I know of. Fairfax Hospital is in the process of considering one, and I'm on an ethics, as you mentioned, the ethics forum at Fairfax Hospital is considering establishing another committee or subcommittee or something like that, which may function in this way. But again, all of this is really at the forefront of the field of medical ethics.
Why is there more, it appears to be, more decisions to be made in the ethical realm of medicine now?
Well, I think that this is a reflection of high-tech medicine, as it were, where the technology has gone so far, technology in terms of life support systems, life-sustaining systems, and we in society have not yet come to grips with the ethical problems that this technology has created. These ethical problems did not exist 100 years ago when there was very little option in medicine. It was either, to put it very simply, you cut off a leg to survive from gangrene or you don't. And also there was very little medicine, which also raises similar moral questions.
How many hospitals in the country now have an ethics committee to deal with?
I think the recent study has shown that about 1% has an ethics committee, which is not the life support committee. An ethics committee can serve a wide variety of functions. Minimally, it can serve an educational function for the hospital staff.
And what about medical hospitals? Just do they teach ethics?
Well, hospitals don't teach ethics that I'm aware of. They occasionally have conferences. Medical schools occasionally have a requirement in medical ethics, and this is a big change in medical schools. A recent survey I've seen shows that over half of the medical schools now have some requirement in medical ethics that includes a course or maybe just a seminar or something like that, and that really is going to change things around.
Well, Dr. Rothbard has been active in promoting education on the subject of medical ethics, including conferences through Fairfax Hospital. I want to thank you for joining us today, Dr. Rothbard. I'm Penny Goodman. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking. Our technician today is Michelle Lassane. And if you have questions about our program or our guest, please call 323-2138. Thank you for listening.